You're listening to Spellbound.
Welcome to episode 20 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to it anywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox today and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app for both iOS and Android. You'll have to excuse my voice in the intro and outro and advertisement in today's episode because I'm recording this much later and I'm quite hoarse because I had a great day yesterday.
I'm here with Andrew Rader. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Julian.
Today we're doing a continuation of this whole civilization conversation that we've been doing on the podcast for the last few weeks. I would highly recommend anybody listening to this to go back to episode 17 and listen to that if you haven't already. It was a debate about whether or not technology is a positive force between Andrew and author John Zarzan, whose book, A People's History of Civilization, just came out. After that conversation went down, Andrew and I were talking about the book Brave New World, written by Aldous Huxley in 1933, and we decided to read it together with the intent of having a conversation about it.
Yeah, definitely.
What did you think of Brave New World?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, actually. We can talk about, you know, whether I thought it was realistic or not in a little bit, but overall, I thought it was a really good book. I did nominally read it in school, although I'm not sure I read the whole thing. So it was really good to go back to it and appreciate it, I think, for the first time. And there were a lot of themes that John brought up that appear in the book, but I think actually on both sides of the ledger. So that's something we'll talk about. But I think Brave New World is, so interestingly, Brave New World is a parody of a number of other books written by H.G. Wells.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
okay,
H.G. Wells wrote a number of books about how the future would be awesome, right? And It's kind of like the Soviet propaganda pictures of space, of, you know, the brave man defining technology, going out to conquer the solar system. The Soviets had all these propaganda posters. And it's kind of like that. And H.G. Wells thought the future would be amazing. And he was talking about all these new inventions and how the social programs would totally change in the future and everyone would live differently. And he thought this was a great thing. And Aldous Huxley thought he'd write a parody of it to talk about maybe some of the downsides. Because I think it kind of gets back to what we were talking about with John, where everything in life is a trade-off. And so there's actually some good things about this future and some not so great things.
I mean, a parody doesn't seem entirely accurate. Maybe like a criticism.
Yeah, but it's a criticism. Well, it's a criticism through a novel. So it's kind of telling a story, but you're supposed to infer from that the negative aspects of it. And in that sense,
right,
it's a parody. It's not like a ha-ha funny parody exactly,
right,
but it's a parody in that it's taking something very literally and presenting it in a sense that tells the opposite message.
Right. I see what you mean. Yeah. I would just want to encourage listeners, if you haven't listened to episode 17, definitely check that out. And also, if you haven't read Brave New World, we are going to be discussing it. Andrew and I literally just finished this. I just finished it like an hour ago, literally.
Yeah.
Right before you got here. You finished yesterday?
Yeah.
I was amazed by how good the story was, just as like a, just the character development and like the setup of the world. And just from a literary perspective, it makes so much sense why it's a classic. All of the criticisms of technology and civilization from, I mean, it was written in 1933. It's pretty astounding.
Yeah, it's actually published in 1933, written in 1931.
Really?
He wrote it in one summer, I think a couple of months or something like that, while he was in the south of France on vacation. He took a sabbatical
And
then wrote the whole book in a couple of months. And it's a commentary on a number of things, a number of themes that were going on at the time. The Soviet Union was just emerging, so Stalin had just taken over and was instituting his five-year plans. And a lot of people on both sides of the equation, actually, both capitalists and communists, thought that the Soviet Union might be the future. And this is the collectivism, I think, in the book. So I think it's a lot of commentary on that. It's really interesting, though, that the future he presents is a strange mix of communism and capitalism, which is why I think it probably doesn't really work. Like, the incentives, I can't imagine how this kind of future would actually come about. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think it's realistic, but he kind of mashes all these ideas that were swirling in people's head at the same time, because it was also at the worst point of the Great Depression when he wrote the book.
Oh, so interesting.
Capitalism was in doubt. Everyone thought that the economic system of the world had collapsed, and he was trying to find out what the future is going to be like with all these emerging technologies, the Soviet Union looming, and it kind of seeming to make good progress, and capitalist society kind of collapsing in the United States and Germany and Western Europe.
So you think it's a mixture of capitalism and communism? Explain that.
What I think it really is, it's a collective future. So if anyone's a Star Trek fan, this future is the Borg. basically. There's a number of interesting quotes. We are one, all belong to all, everyone works for everyone else. These are some of the lines that they say.
This is from the Borg?
No, this is from Brave New World.
It's everyone belongs to everyone else, right?
Everyone belongs to everyone else.
Okay.
And they also say we are one and all belong to all. Everyone works for everyone else. These are lines from the book, the things that they say about their society, right? Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the French edition of Brave New World, the title is The Best of All Worlds. Hmm. And if anyone knows about Star Trek, the Borg episode where Captain Picard gets captured is called The Best of Both Worlds. And this society is effectively the Borg. They have purged their emotions and they basically networked themselves to work together.
It doesn't sound too dissimilar from our world today.
That's very interesting.
Uber is kind of like working, everyone works for everyone else, you know, all these automated services that you can do just from your phone. Like, that's basically this picture of everyone works for everyone else, everyone belongs to everyone else. So you can already start to see traces of it.
Yeah, I'm actually reading, I just started last night, a book about networks throughout the world, and it talks about how networks played a really important role a couple hundred years ago with the Illuminati, which you've mentioned actually, but is kind of the secret network, but doesn't exist anymore, despite what people think. And how networks are actually reappearing with social networks to become an important force in the world. And the question is whether networks bring us together, like in the book, Brave New World, or networks actually facilitate communications that drive us apart. And I think that's actually really what we're seeing with division today. Mm. So this is why I think the book is kind of unrealistic, because if you have this kind of interconnectivity of people, it actually, I think, creates rifts between people and drives them apart and creates more dissonance and more discord and more differences of opinions. And you could never have this kind of society, because the thing that I find really interesting about Brave New World is their society is collectivized. They're all working together and they all have a place and they're supposed to maintain order. In fact, their motto, the motto of the society, is a play on the French Revolution. French Revolution was liberté, égalité, fraternité. So liberty, equality, fraternity.
That was some serious French maneuvering.
Bilingual. Yeah. I grew up in Canada. So.
Yeah.
And their motto is community, identity, stability, which is also another really interesting thing, because this society is the definition of community. So John was always talking about the loss of community. This society is what you have when you have extreme community, I think. You have everyone fit into place, into a community, playing a role, a cog in the machine, part of the greater whole, and you lose individuality and creativity. Right. So I think that's the downside of community. And John was talking about how community is such a great thing. And I think Brave New World is the very future that John fears.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's actually the definition of community, which he's striving for. It's like Brave New World is as if the entire world was one family or one tribe. Everyone's working together and has a place and has a role and knows their place and is presumably, I mean, actually, they make it seem happy about their place.
Right. Blissfully ignorant.
Blissfully ignorant. And it's destroyed individuality and it's destroyed curiosity. That's the bad thing about it. It's destroyed science. They're basically stuck at a plateau. And interestingly, the plateau, if you notice the year about it, so the year is 632 AF after Ford. So they take Henry Ford, the assembly line, as their basically their god.
Right.
Ford. 632 is another foundational year. It's the start of Islam. That's why it's 632. It's the start of a new religion.
Oh.
That's when
so then I was
Muhammad
saying,
made his pilgrimage from Mecca to Medina. That's the start. Islam takes 632 as the start of their year zero on a calendar.
Okay. So is that true?
That's symbolic. Yeah, that's true. So they're using Aldous Huxley, the author, is using 632 as a symbol for the start of a new era,
I
basically.
See. Okay, so he's not saying it is Islam.
Oh,
he's
no. He's saying using it as a symbol for the start of a new era. Anyway, getting back to why it couldn't work is because everyone's collectivized, but they're also incentivized to buy things. The whole society is based on consumerism. So the Soviets, for example, had mass production, right? And they were trying to maximize production of all things, but they weren't very good at it because the incentive structure doesn't work under communism. And that's why communism basically fails, because there really aren't incentives for people to compete and to get ahead. So in this society, they've got kind of this organic consumptionism, right? But I don't think that really goes with the communism that they apparently also have. So I think it's kind of this weird hybrid between capitalism and communism that wouldn't actually work without some kind of dictatorial control. And the other thing that's interesting about the Society in Brave New World is they apparently have no dictatorial control. Like, there really isn't any authoritarianism other than at birth, they're conditioned right after birth and actually bred to perform certain roles. So they have a caste system from alpha through epsilon, which is the Greek letters. And each member of society has a place, and they're conditioned through like electric shock therapy to basically slot into their place. And they're also manipulated with chemicals at birth to fit into that place.
Right. They don't question anything. They don't know any different than what they know. And each of these groups are conditioned differently to accept their place in the system.
Exactly. And be happy with it.
Right.
But there's no one apparently telling them to be that way after they're released from the birthing facility, right? They go out into society, and then the protagonist of the book comes up with his own ideas and thinks he's an individual. That's Bernard. And no one's apparently really telling him, you know, not to be this way. The police don't arrest him. Like, there's a lot of futures.
Well, it's in secret, right? That was the impression I got.
Nah, I mean, there's a lot of signs. I mean, even so, like, even with John, who comes back and is clearly, like, John's the character in the book that they take from the reservation of, they call them savages, but basically people who are, quote, uncivilized, not integrated into society. They come in, and there doesn't seem to be really a lot of control. I mean, they do eventually talk to the director, but they're not kind of directing them. Everyone just thinks they're a bit weird. It's the main method of control seems to be, to me, peer pressure. Everyone just kind of thinks you're a bit strange.
You could say that they have the opposite world that we live in today in terms of the peers aren't intermingling across their caste. So you've got like deltas hanging out with deltas, gammas hanging out with gammas, alphas hanging out with alphas, and epsilons everybody's hanging out with their own group. And so they're just that combined with their conditioning and their soma, their drugs, it's like there's no reason to question anything else because people just go in and they clock into work every day and they clock out and then they go home and take their soma ration that they get every day. And then nobody seems to question it until the very end. And when John is like, I think it's John or Bernard takes the daily soma ration for all the deltas or something, and they start like losing it and they attack him.
Yeah. John at the end of
like
it, yeah.
He takes their drugs and then they're like losing their minds. I don't think it's that unrealistic because everything is conditioning. What's interesting to me about is this idea of language. Like you were just saying how this interconnectivity of people kind of erodes community at a certain point because it allows you to talk on a level that is actually kind of polarizing. When you're mixing people of different countries who speak different languages and stuff. Last week's episode on the podcast was with a cognitive scientist, and she's talking about how the language you speak affects your perspective of everything. So that's why, you know, you can have totally different worldviews in different countries and they're just not compatible with each other. So in theory, if there was one language that we all spoke, maybe that interconnectivity wouldn't be such a bad thing.
You're right. The interconnectivity, I think, this is why I think it would fly apart, is because I think it can actually create division and dissent because you're hearing different viewpoints, right? I guess maybe nowadays we have the problem where we're stuck in our little echo chambers, our bubbles. But I think that interconnectivity, if it is actual interconnectivity, lets you hear dissenting viewpoints and people kind of go off in different directions. And you have this as the exception that proves the rule in the book with Bernard, who thinks of himself differently, and he's basically able to, well, I guess he doesn't institute long-term change, but no one really comes after him. He's able to express his views. And I think that there would be more Bernards. I don't know how effective conditioning would really be, but who's enforcing the conditioning? Like, why isn't someone questioning why they're being conditioned at some point? Because especially the alphas, they talk about the alphas are not as conditioned, and they left some people who are able to actually freely think and things like that. And Bernard is actually one of them. So I think the society would just come apart at the seams, probably, A. And B, I don't see how it would get established in the first place because people are always going to be questioning things. And like, I could just see a society becoming like this, but only by authoritarian control from the top. And there doesn't seem to be that. It's like this organic grassroots decision that people made collectively.
Well, Mustafa Mond is a world controller. He's one of 10.
Yeah, he's called a world controller, but he doesn't seem to exert his authority a lot or aggressively, as at least well, compared to a lot of dystopian. Well, I suppose that's true.
Because this world they've created is already in place. But I would actually say that I think there's another way that this world could come about, not just through control and stuff, but also through, like, you know, people love convenience. People love their technology. People don't want to think. Most people don't want to think. Most people are perfectly happy just going to watch an Avengers movie and, you know, smoking some weed or doing whatever they're going to do at night and then just zoning out after work, which is already kind of like 90% of the way there to this Brave New World picture.
Yeah, but I think society's always been like that. I think, you know, we can't say that is a difference. People have probably, you know, people used to go work at the factory for 12 hours, come and go to the pub after and spend everything they'd earned, you know, at the bar. And I mean, that's, I guess that's industrial society, as John would say. But people, I guess before that, peasants would toil in the fields and do the same thing. So I think that's kind of just, like, John might have a point in a sense that it's a product of civilization that we
Want to dope ourselves.
Yeah. Rather than kind of having to think all the time. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's along a trajectory that's changing, is what I'm saying. I don't think it's getting worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think people want to think a lot less than they ever have. I think people are perfectly happy just watching cat videos on YouTube. And, like,
yeah,
you've seen, like, entertainment has definitely taken a plunge for, like, for the worse, I think you could say. And I think that's reflected in ticket sales.
Yeah.
It's, you can see that in the box office sales. You can see it in, I mean, just when you watch, I mean, we were just talking about a few minutes ago before we hit the record button, we were talking about how the greatest villain of all time is from Schindler's List, is what you were saying.
Like, that's because it's subtle.
Pretty old movie.
Yeah.
Now that's a movie that's a movie that requires you to think. When you're watching Schindler's List, you can't just sit there and watch it like you'd watch an Avengers movie.
Well, they don't make movies like they used to, like Casablanca or something. I find that one boring, frankly, but yeah, exactly. But movies used to be about really good storytelling, and now there are still some like that, but you have to look a lot harder, but mostly it's about a big blockbuster with lots of action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's because, you know, that reaches a lot of people and makes money. That's sort of a result of capitalism trying to maximize audience and that sort of thing.
It's almost like, okay, so you take the Epsilons who are doing all the grunt work in this world, and, you know, they have, like, all this conditioning that tells them to just be, like, thankful that they're Epsilons, mm-hmm. and they have these, like, loudspeakers in the factories that are saying, mm-hmm. Epsilons are useful.
Yeah, there was a great thing, the elevator operator. So back then, they didn't even have, like, the elevators running themselves, because they used to have people, literally, in our society, used to have people running the elevators, right?
Right.
So pressing the buttons. And they have an Epsilon who's conditioned to think everything is amazing,
right?
And he just gets so excited when they get to the ceiling, because he's rediscovering it for the first time every time. The roof. And he's like, the roof. And basically, like, looking up and sees the sky, and he's super excited. And, like, bus drivers and things like this are, like, just thrilled to do their job, because they get really excited because they're conditioned to be that way and bred to be that way, basically.
Yeah. So they've conditioned a group of people to not want to think. And well, those people do most of the grunt work.
To be happy. Like, so the question is, why is that bad? I mean, I think it's bad.
Well, I don't think it is bad necessarily. It's just, it's just interesting to talk about. Because here's the thing. Like, you could say that maybe that makes life better, because there are certain aspects of capitalism that suck. I mean, there are certain aspects of any system that sucks. I mean, grunt work always sucks. Whether you're making, you know, $10 an hour or deep seven figures, there's definitely parts of your job that you hate. You know, for everybody that goes, mm-hmm. there's nobody that doesn't hate a certain part of their job. And so in my mind, it's almost like by participating in this system, you have to kind of agree to turn off a part of your brain, because you're going to just have to put up with this, like, grunt work. But I mean, I guess you could say that that's no different than just being living out in as a hunter gatherer, like out in the elements in nature.
Well, they're forced to hunt and gather. Mm-hmm, like, yeah. I mean, I think everyone through history and today also is a prisoner of their circumstances. They have to do certain things to stay alive. That's just life. Mm-hmm. That's life for animals too. You know, they have to do certain things to stay alive. And it gets back to the whole purpose. Like, what is life? In the book, everyone is, you know, at least the way they present it, is happy, right?
Right, yeah.
Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, that's the part of me that's really torn about this book, because I actually, I was expecting to read it and be like, oh God, this is totally what's going to happen and it's going to be terrible. But actually some of it, I'd say half of it, I was like, okay, I can see how this would need to happen at some point in the future. I can see how some of these changes would need to happen, but I don't actually think that half of these are bad necessarily.
Absolutely.
I think some of them could actually improve life for people. I think I'm actually amazed that such an old book could be so specific about the problems that were going to arise 100 years later.
Yeah, it's basically 100 years ago. Yeah,
so crazy.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of good things about the society. Like, there's total social liberation, essentially. You can be homosexual, you could be, you know, promiscuous, you could do whatever you want, basically, and everyone's cool with it. Like, it's like party all the time, basically, and no one cares about what you do.
Yeah, I mean, and no one cares about death.
Right. I mean, everyone's happy, everyone's basically free. I mean, they're free to operate within their box, but I actually think because of the main character, Bernard, they're free to even operate outside their box. They're just less likely to because they've been conditioned to be inside their box.
Right.
But it's not like the police comes and arrests you if you try to operate at least a little bit outside your box, right? At least personally. If you try to, like, totally overturn society, maybe you're going to run into problems with the world controller, but basically you can kind of do whatever you want. Like,
this would be a difference between Brave New World and 1984.
That's what I think. Yeah, exactly. Like, 1984 is all bad, basically.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of dystopian societies that are all bad, like Handmaid's Tale, 1984, Fahrenheit 451. These are all, like, bad societies. Brave New World is an interesting mix of both good and bad.
I felt that way, too.
Yeah.
It's super interesting book.
And in the end, what is the meaning of life?
In the end of Brave New World or in the end of our life?
No, in reality, for us, what is the purpose of life? Like, if you're happy, is that enough, right? Because there's actually only four things that make you happy in life.
What is it? You look like you're about to say it.
Dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins.
Okay,
are the
so
only
happiness
things that make
is chemical.
It is. Well, that's the thing. So there are only four things that actually make you happy, and they're all brain chemicals.
Well, you could say those are like symptoms of a happiness-inducing event.
Well, right. So that's why they take Soma, which is like a drug with no side effects, presumably, and basically keeps them happy all the time. If they want to go on Soma holiday, they say they can just zone out on drugs for a month, basically.
So I guess the question is, are there meaningful events that are worth experiencing genuine happiness over, or is
it... Well, that is genuine. I mean, like truly...
A Soma trip is genuine happiness?
Well, it is. I mean, okay. If your brain thinks your brain is you. Like, if your brain thinks you're happy, then you're happy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are you not?
Yeah, I guess so. I also think... Yeah.
So there's an interesting question. Do you need unhappy events to be happy? Like, life is full of ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And if you had no down... This is a society where you have no downs. So you just go up all the time.
I think that's a bad thing.
Why?
Because I think life is about balance.
Yeah, but isn't that just because we can't achieve up all the time?
If you can't have... Well, I don't think we can achieve...
I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, no, this is great. This is great. I would say there's no point in even having a word for happiness if there's nothing opposing it, if there's no force opposing it. Why even have a word for it?
Well, why... I mean, if you can wire your brain to constantly experience positive chemicals and be happy, would that be a good thing? I mean, they do this with rats, actually, experiments with rats, and they kind of give them a button where they can press and release dopamine into their brain, which, you know, makes them happy. And the rats get addicted. They just keep pressing the button.
Of course they
forever.
Do.
Well, right. I mean,
that's what I would
the same
do.
Thing is
give
like,
me a happiness in a
like
button.
Like a junkie or something like that. Yeah, they just keep, you know, pressing the button, right?
Right. I wouldn't actually do this button.
Okay,
let's say
you're right and that life should be full of up and downs. And I actually agree. I think life has up and downs. And there's something beyond pure brain chemical happiness, a sense of accomplishment.
It makes you more highly evolved to experience more diversity in that way.
If
it makes you more tolerant to when things don't go well. It teaches you, it builds your character. It gives you more life experience. Yeah, I think it makes you stronger to experience diversity.
I agree with that, but I can't say why. And I don't think anyone has ever in the history of humanity come up with an answer of why that's true.
Well, I think diversity is the cornerstone of life in all aspects, even down to happiness.
Yeah, but fundamentally, happiness is brain chemicals. So, why couldn't you just generate the same level of... Let's say there was a brain chemical for fulfillment or satisfaction or whatever, accomplishment, whatever else we want to say is beyond happiness. I mean, this comes back to, like, if you could turn yourself into a computer, mm-hmm. and, you know, get rid of your body and just turn your brain up, you'll upload your consciousness into a computer, you know, would that not be as fulfilling?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. The book is kind of constantly prodding at this philosophical question of happiness because it, you know, it even depicts Linda, who was, and this is a spoiler alert, Linda is a character that pops up about a third of the way through the book, and she's the estranged lover of the controller of this brave new world, the guy who's in charge of, like, basically running, making sure that the machine works on a macro level. It comes out that he had a fling a long time ago with this girl that was exiled to the middle of nowhere and to live with this tribe. And she ended up having the son of this guy, unbeknownst to him, unbeknownst to the controller of the Brave New World. She had his son and raised him in the jungle. And eventually, through a series of crazy events, the controller's long-lost lover comes back to civilization. And she's this interesting character because she's no happier in either setting. She's miserable in both settings. So it's this, her character is kind of prodding at this philosophical question of happiness, like, is civilization better? Is, you know, it's kind of like, basically she's on the crux of the argument that you had with John a couple weeks ago, basically. But it's an interesting question. And it's hard to say, like, where the author wants you to fall on that argument. He kind of leaves it up to you, I think.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating.
Totally agree.
I want him to tell me what he thinks.
I think we can get some insight into how the author felt by looking at who he was. So Aldous Huxley was the grandson of T.H. Huxley, who was Darwin's bulldog. And he was the public face of evolution, basically. So he went and took on creationists about evolution. So
when you say he was Darwin's bulldog, yep. You mean he's the guy that goes after people in public or
yeah,
his literal pet?
No. The guy goes after people in public. So Darwin got a lot of, was attacked by a lot of creationists who thought he was extrapolating evolution to suggest that humans descended from apes, which Darwin at one point, I think, denied. But later on, he actually thought that that must be true. And Darwin was religious, actually. He trained to be a pastor. And he instead decided to go on the Beagle and become a naturalist and study the natural world. And he came up with his idea of evolution. And towards the end of his life, he was sort of questioning his faith. Darwin was. But he never really sort of took on the world. He basically said, this is an idea, evolution. This is an idea that I think is true. But he never really fought for it very much other than just writing his books. But T.H. Huxley, who's Aldous Huxley's grandfather, was called Darwin's bulldog because he was sort of the public face backing Darwin and challenging people outright and having debates about it and trying to convince the world that this was true. So Darwin just said, here's my idea. But T.H. Huxley was the one who really kind of tried to sell the idea to the world. That's his grandfather. And he himself was a humanist and a pacifist. And I think he would have been relatively pro-technology. He certainly knows a lot about it.
Right.
But he also said, hey guys, we have to tread carefully, basically. So I think it's sort of his warning about the possible dangers of technology, but I don't think he is an anti-technology person.
I think that's how I feel. I kind of feel like that. I'm pro-technology, but right. I'm also kind of like, okay, I could see how this could get really out of hand if we're not careful.
Right. Yeah, you want certain brakes and controls and things like that. So I think that's probably what he was trying to get at. Whereas a lot of other people like H.G. Wells, as I said, it was a parody. So H.G. Wells was really excited about the future. Bring it on. The more technology, the better.
Right.
And Aldous Huxley was like, whoa, guys, like, this is
great.
But let's be careful because here's some downsides and here's some paths that could go along. And I think that's kind of his contribution to the world is this idea that we need to be careful.
Let's go ahead and put a pin right there to talk about the people who made today's episode possible. We're talking about Audible. Audiobooks are a great sidekick for summer activities like hiking, beaching it up, running, road tripping, enjoying downtime outside, pretty much any time you could wear headphones and do something else. It's a great time to listen to an audiobook. Listening is a better way to binge content you love while doing things you love is what I'm trying to say. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, which lets you fill your summer with more stories like Brave New World, for example. I actually listened to Brave New World through Audible on an audiobook, and it was a great way to just listen to that book quickly because I needed to listen to it this week, and it was super helpful. quite a coincidence that Audible ended up sponsoring this episode on the back end of that. I personally loved being able to switch devices listening to Brave New World. I would listen to some of it on my laptop, some of it on my phone, in my car, on my headphones, and I was constantly changing devices. It was so nice that Audible remembered where I was at the end of each time, and no matter which device I was on, it picked up right where I left off. Super convenient. And you can listen while doing pretty much anything. Audible members get a credit every month, good for any audiobook in the store, regardless of price. And unused credits roll over to next month every time. If you didn't like your audiobook, you can always exchange it, no questions asked. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you've canceled your membership. Start a 30-day trial today and get your first audiobook for free. Go to audible.com/spellbound or text spellbound to 500-500.
That's what I said. You can get a free audiobook just by going to audible.com/spellbound. Or by texting SPELLBOUND to 500-500.
We can actually talk about some of the technologies because, as you said, this was written in the early 1930s. 1931 was written, published in 1933. And so because this takes place about 500 years from now, so about 600 years in the future from that point, he obviously had some interesting ideas about the future. So we have to be careful here, too, because I think that technology in Brave New World has plateaued. So they talk about this. They actually destroyed all their books. They've basically just dismantled science. They rely on the products of science. So they're basically creating people in a lab and conditioning them. But they've dismantled the tools of science. Science is basically asking questions. What would happen if? And then answering those questions by looking at data from the real world. So running experiments in the real world and seeing how what actually happens. So instead of trying to figure it out by like thinking through what might happen, you come up with like questions, that's a hypothesis, and then you do a run an experiment and see what actually happens. So I think in Brave New World, they're not experimenting. They're not doing science anymore.
Right. They've got it all figured out pretty much.
But they've got a level of science that is more advanced than certainly 1931. And in some ways, it's maybe comparable to the world today. It's about maybe 100 years in the future from 1931, but they've got certain things right and certain things wrong. So some interesting things. Television, for example, they talk about hotel rooms, how every hotel room has a television. This is pretty interesting because the first television broadcast was in 1936. So this is about 5 years before that. Television, I guess it was kind of known in a sense.
But this is before the TV that he predicted
this.
Yeah,
before television, yep.
So people, when this book came out, didn't even know what a TV was?
Most people probably didn't know what a television was. I mean, most people had never seen one before.
Wow.
They may have heard of it like some futuristic thing. Like it might be kind of like nuclear fusion or something. It's a technology that we don't have yet, but we know is theoretically possible. So, but he uses it just offhand, like, television in every room, right?
Right.
Televisions became popular for the masses. Like, most people got a television into their home in the 1950s, maybe even the early 60s.
Right, I was going to say early 60s.
So, like, 30 years later, really, and television was barely invented, you know, at the time, but he used it really offhand. Helicopters is another one like that. Helicopters, I think the first helicopter flight was maybe in the 1920s or something, but they weren't widespread at all until after World War II. So the 1950s, I mean, helicopters were really new, and he uses it as like the main thing that people
everywhere.
Fly around in. Yeah, everyone has like a personal helicopter. So instead of cars, you basically have a helicopter, right? So he was kind of, what he was doing was taking the most advanced technologies that he could think of that hadn't been introduced yet, in widespread at least, but sort of had been barely invented, and he's just making them widespread. He also talks about rocket planes. In fact, he has this interesting idea where he says that some of the epsilons or deltas, the lower castes, have been conditioned to enjoy being upside down all the time so they can be mechanics on the rocket planes.
Right.
So they hang on the bottom of the rocket planes, which is really interesting because obviously...
Because you love being upside down?
Well, we don't exactly have rocket planes. A rocket is slightly different from a jet. Rocket planes did exist, but they're not that practical. But also, the idea of having to go out in midair and kind of work on the engines is kind of ridiculous. But at the time, in the 1920s and 30s, that's what people did. Like, if you've seen aerobatics and stuff from the 1920s and 30s with the biplanes and all the strings attaching all the wings, people literally had to go out sometimes and restart the engine. Right, so they go crawl out on the wing and like hit the engine with a hammer and like fix the engine midair
while the plane's flying.
While the plane's flying
while
midair,
it's falling.
While it, Well, I'm talking about a plane generally with two engines, but a plane can glide really far, actually.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So people were getting out on...
We've become so weak.
This image of people getting out on the wings and fixing the engines while the plane is flying makes sense, but it sounds utterly ridiculous in the context of a rocket plane.
Right.
Right?
That's insane.
Yeah. So he's got these really interesting views of technology, but basically everyone is born through... not even IVF, but actually just in a lab. It's similar to in vitro. They just have the sperms and the eggs, and then they split into up to 16,000 clones.
Right.
So they basically have...
from one egg, right?
Yeah. It's called the Bukhanovsky process, and they split them into up to 16,000 different eggs. So people are clones because clones will... fill a gap better, right? They'll be kind of all the same and be uniform and create more social cohesion, which actually gets back to my thing about this is a family. Like the whole world is one big family. It's one big tribe. This is, if you want community, this is it. Like this is what community means if taken to the extreme.
It probably is the best picture you can think of community and technology coexisting.
It is. Yeah, exactly. So this
Which is crazy.
This is exactly one thing that John hates. John Zerzan, there's a character John in the book, so we're getting a bit confused, but one thing that John hates and one thing that John loves mesh together.
Right.
Basically.
Right.
And one thing that, well, I don't hate community, but I guess we're sort of the opposite in a sense. And I guess we would like the opposite parts of this world. It's really interesting.
You mean you and me?
No, me and John.
Or you and John.
So basically,
yeah.
I like the individuality because I think it, you know, creates creativity and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And competition, right? John likes the community. John hates the technology. I like the technology. So the things that, so there's one thing about this society that John would love, one thing that he would hate. And for me, it's kind of the exact opposite things turned 180 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think creativity is a positive force, and I totally understand how community could get in the way of that because I'm way more productive when I'm just locking myself in a room and just like hammering out some stuff, and I don't have to worry about calling anybody back or like seeing anyone. And those hours when I do that are super productive for me. So I could see how creativity and community aren't totally compatible, but I also think everything in life is about balance. So I think you need both. I think we've evolved to be creative beings, but we're also communal beings. And so we have to have community and we have to be able to invent new tools. So I think you need both. And I think that's one positive thing about this world to me is that they've found a way to kind of let people do that all the time in a way that's harmonious with technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
They found a way to make sure.
Can't be alone. That's the other people.
That's true.
They are basically unable to be alone, and they say, "Why would you ever want to be alone? You know, why wouldn't you always want to be surrounded by people who are just like you, and you know, taking drugs together and going to your parties together and that kind of thing?" And
that part I don't like because
no, exactly.
I like being alone.
That's one of Aldous Huxley's things. Is he's saying individuality is really important. It's what makes us who we are, and that's I think that's kind of one of his messages that we have to be free to express ourselves. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe the idea of people not being allowed to be alone is driven by some, agenda to squelch the, I mean, if you're alone, it's much easier to think of yourself as an individual than it is if you're just with a bunch of other people all the time. So it's, maybe that's, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Other technologies, all the movies are 3D. They have what's called stereoscopic movies.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, but they're big blockbusters that everyone thinks has terrible storylines.
Really?
Yeah, they're talking about how, oh, yeah, we just kind of show a bunch of action sequences and everyone just loves it, which is crazy for 1931, yeah. Where they had black and, like, this is before Gone with the Wind, it's before Casablanca, it's before, like, any movie you probably have heard of. I don't think I've ever seen a movie from back then. Wings, actually, I think I've seen, which was from the... right around then.
For him to have called 3D technology stereoscopic is really ahead of his time because he's basically, it's the realization that with two cameras, you could create depth.
Exactly.
Which is like way ahead of its time.
Yeah, exactly.
We didn't actually invent that technology till like decades after this book came out,
exactly.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. So he's, you know.
And that's what we call it, is stereoscopic. We call it stereoscopic to this day.
Well, most people call it 3D, I think, right?
Stereoscopic is what they call it. Yeah.
Also, electric shock therapy. I think this was probably invented before then, but I don't know that it was widely applied. But there's a lot of controversy, obviously, with that today. Like, whether, you know, you can shock away the gay and stuff like that. Mike Pence got accused of wanting to do that, for example.
He wanted to do what?
He's denied it, that he believes in electroshock therapy for gay conversion, basically.
What?
Yeah.
He wants to turn people to not be gay?
Right,
yeah. To shock therapy?
Yeah, yeah.
Who is this guy?
He's the vice president.
Oh, my God.
No, he's denied it, actually. But he's been accused of wanting to do that. But anyway, but this was a big thing back in the day for, like, prisoners and stuff. It comes up in Clockwork Orange. So it prefigures, you know, a lot of experiments that tried to do this later on. And Clockwork Orange is a movie that they try to, they condition the character to hate violence, basically. So he gets sick every time he experiences violence, and then people end up manipulating him and taking advantage of him. So it's a great movie. It's got awesome music, but it's kind of a depressing one too.
Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, he's like my favorite director. Yeah.
Yeah, me too, probably. Yeah. The 3D stuff, the way he called it stereoscopic, is pretty insightful, but it's also kind of, this is for me one of those foresights that's not totally accurate, because he's got the stereoscopic imaging, and then he's got the feelies, which the feelies is what they call their movie theaters.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have the feely effect, because there's this little thing you hold up to your nose, and it's unclear whether or not it's just a scent that comes through. It kind of suggests that people who use the feely tunnel can also feel stuff,
yeah,
and not just smell. So it's like through smelling it, they're getting the full effect, which to me, between the feely effect and the stereoscopic imaging, it feels more like he's getting it VR than he is actually 3D movies.
That's true, actually. Yeah,
but it's like
point.
He wasn't able to quite articulate it or something, because 3D movies have already kind of come and gone, I would argue. Like, there's not really many movies that are coming out in 3D anymore. And when they do, it's kind of an event. And that fad, died out a few years ago. There was, 2 years, 2013 to 2015, where every movie was coming out in 3D. And now you just don't see that anymore, because people are kind of over it, I think.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing with, we're not sure what technologies will actually take off. Like, back
VR
in 2010,
everyone
was going to have wearable computers.
Right.
And now no one really does, right? We can make wearable computers, but people just don't really like them that much.
They'll like VR.
Yeah, maybe if it's realistic enough. But actually, so that's another version of his VR is the Soma, actually. So Soma, you can go on a vacation and, you know, experience all kinds of hallucinations, and you have dreams about where you're going. I think that is also his version of VR.
Yeah, that's true.
Where you're kind of immersing yourself in a world. And in that way, the book is a bit like Ready Player One, where the world is kind of horrible outside and everyone's immersing themselves in this online VR world to escape.
How likely do you think that is?
I think more likely than Brave New World, but only because it's more recent.
Because that basically suggests that the environment gets so bad, like we don't fix any of the environmental problems, and so people can't go outside, is basically what that idea suggests.
Well, I don't know about that. The world is not great. It's hard to tell how bad it actually is in Ready Player One, whether people do go outside. I mean, he talks about constant wars, what city was nuked last week, and talks about environmental degradation, but it's unclear that people do go outside, right? And so, I don't know. So, but they spend the most of their time I think it's more because they're just addicted to this immersive environment, and that's more compelling to them than real life.
And that's the part of me that I guess is kind of doesn't like reading books like Brave New World, because I just don't like thinking that the world could come to something like that. But then I'm like, well, we won't let it get that bad. The environment will get better because people will start to embrace the problems we're having, and we'll actually start to make some headway. But then you turn on the news and you see that people are still arguing about whether or not global warming is happening. And it's like, how are we still arguing about this stuff? And that's the part of me that thinks that's maybe not that crazy, that we could still be arguing about this until we literally just burn ourselves out of the galaxy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the tragedy of the commons. So every person's individual contribution makes a negligible difference, but the sum total of everyone's contribution makes a major difference.
Right.
So it's hard to change. You can change your own behavior, but it hardly matters. You need to change everyone else's behavior at the same time, which is really tough.
That's tough.
That's the problem. And that's actually what's unrealistic about Brave New World, is that everyone seems to organically believe that this societal cohesion is a good thing. And there's these world controllers, but they don't seem to influence a lot of power.
Well, you could say that their influence was eliminating art and religion and, you know, all the things that they did to, you know, what was the other things they got rid of because they thought they were distractions and kept people at odds with each other? It was art, religion, and what else? It was a couple of other things.
Science. History.
History.
Yeah, they destroy all the books.
Yeah,
before
the books.
Ford,
basically. Information, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. People don't have access to information, so they don't think outside the box and stuff like that. But they clearly haven't been ultimately successful in that because Bernard, the main character, breaks away from that and actually has his own thoughts.
So first of all, I think Bernard's like a fictional character. Yeah. You can't have a story without a protagonist that sees the world differently than everybody else. So, you mean, I don't think just to say that Bernard exists in this fictional world doesn't mean that there's a flaw with the program. I think it just means that it's a story and they're exploring some ideas.
No, I agree, but I think that it couldn't get started because not everyone's going to subscribe to the same program. Like, everyone's going to have different ideas about what to do, and I just don't see how this gets started without major authoritarianism, which doesn't seem to be present. It seems to be like a very benign future, even though it's maybe quashing the best elements of humanity, like individuality and curiosity and things like that. But it seems to be relatively benign. Like, everyone's happy. It's not like they're locking people up. They're taking people away. It's not like, again, 1984, Handmaid's Tale, Big Brother's watching you. They just kind of rely on, well, everyone's just going to do their job and everyone's going to be happy. And we want people to be happy. That's like the message. Everyone should just be happy all the time.
So what about the way that history books get changed and stuff like that over time? Like, you know, we know that that not everything we learn in elementary school about the way our country got started is accurate and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are some factual corrections, but a lot of it's just different perspectives over time. We, as a collective society, change our thinking, and not everyone's in lockstep, and that creates a lot of this disconnect that we see today, a lot of the divide in our society between, you know, really conservative people, really socialist people, and everything in between. Because not everyone's on the same page. Like Abraham Lincoln, for example, freed the slaves, was probably the best president ever, did an awesome job holding the country together in war, but he was pretty racist by today's standards. You know, he believed, actually before the presidency, he thought that they should take all the slaves and export them to Liberia, which was kind of the idea at the time, right? Send them to Liberia, get rid of them, instead of trying to integrate them into society.
He wanted a homogenous society or something?
Yeah, I think he maybe thought it would be easier for society, but he didn't, for example, I don't think he believed that black people were equal to white people. He just thought they had a right to be free, which is not the same as saying everyone's equal, right?
Right.
And it's just that ideas change over time and we get better. We improve over time. Like, I think everyone in the future will be vegetarian. For example,
you're probably right. We're not going to be able to this much meat on the planet.
Right. That's one of the main reasons.
We already don't have enough.
Yeah. But even like some harm is worse than no harm. Like if we could get meat without, even if you think that there's nothing wrong with killing animals from a cruelty perspective, clearly it's a gradient, right? Like, why is killing a person worse than killing an animal?
Well, why is killing an animal worse than killing a plant?
Because they have some level of cognition, some ability to understand their place in the world. They can suffer. Plants can't suffer. So I think the reason is because there's different levels that we recognize of cognition and understanding. And
I think that's a value judgment, right? I mean, like just because we can't understand a plant doesn't mean that they don't feel those things.
But they can't suffer.
You have Jainism.
Yeah. Where you can't kill a fly, for example. Yeah.
There's a word to describe people who subscribe to this, you know?
There's certain religions, and
I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying.
No. And they go to what we would consider extreme, but that's what I'm saying. There's sort of social forces in society that don't always move in one direction, actually, but historically for the past couple hundred years in at least most of the world, they have been kind of becoming more progressive. And not everyone's on the same page. Like, you have this backlash against these kinds of forces. But I think in general, the world is becoming better and we're becoming more enlightened and understanding that actually all people are pretty much the same. Like, in terms of genetic similarity, there's very little difference between people. And even if there wasn't, this is actually something I think about too, is we live at a unique time where we're the only Homo sapiens species on the planet. Like 40,000 years ago, there were Neanderthals.
Right.
And there were also Homo erectus.
It was
before
like five
that.
Or something, right?
Yeah, we were living at the same, humans, our type of humans was living at the same time as like legit other species of humans.
Right.
And
we were all genetically very different. Like you would look at them and say like, this is not even just a different race, but this is a whole other specimen.
Right, right.
Of
and
human.
So how would we treat them? If we the funny thing about humans is we actually look at tiny differences and exaggerate them and get like almost more mad about tiny differences than we do about completely gigantic differences because the way we classify things in our brain. Like if you look at like religious conflict, often it's the tiny differences that really bother people. Like Sunni and Shia are both types of Islam and they fight, but they're pretty similar, you know,
right.
From an outsider's view, but they're just so close, but then they fight about tiny differences, right? And this is the same thing with like Catholicism and Protestantism, like different types of Christianity fight. Even though they're both Christianity, you would think that they would almost fight more with something that's completely different, but often they don't. Like, it's tiny differences that seem to divide us almost more than just completely different differences because we just classify them differently. It's something that's weird in the human brain. The other thing that Brave New World is very similar to another book that came out before, in a sense, called The Time Machine, which is H.G. Wells, actually, interestingly. Which is the book that he was supposed to be parodying. Because the reason it made me think of that is because they have two types of humans. So the protagonist in that book goes far to the future. I think he thinks he's in the past, though. And he finds that there's actually two types of people on Earth who have evolved from us. There's the Morlocks and the Elois. And the Morlocks are like the base nature of us, right? They're aggressive, independent, vicious, really. And they eat the Eloi. And the Eloi are the kind of technologically advanced, weak, science-loving, but actually their curiosity, I think, has gone away. People,
so
but
it's
they're
a cannibalistic
basically like the
system.
the future of humans, basically, if we get too good at entertaining ourselves. The Eloi are basically like the humans who take Soma and have no more ability to fend for themselves, and they become like weak creatures that are defenseless. And the Morlock are sort of the other characteristics of humanity, the aggressiveness and the competition, and they basically prey on the Eloi. But basically, the Eloi are a society that's become too decadent, just plateau of technology. Everyone's just happy and dumb, and they just take their Soma, and it's exactly like Brave New World society, except they also have these Morlocks who are eating them. And it's a book. It's at least an author that Aldous Huxley in Brave New World was trying to parody.
It's also interesting, speaking of savages, the savages in Brave New World are depicted as monogamous, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also having reverence for Jesus.
Yeah.
They're Christian. Mm-hmm. They're a Christian amongst other things, but they've heard of Jesus and they like, which is crazy because a lot of, you know, tribes and stuff are not familiar with Christian doctrine at all because that's a product of Rome and mm-hmm. Western, you know, so it's interesting. But I was curious to ask you what you think about that because it's like, in Brave New World, the undeveloped parts of the world are portrayed as having assumed the position of civilization 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
Yeah.
And then civilization, they're kind of primitive now.
Yeah.
It's like flopped. And so I guess I'm wondering if that's like a flaw or if that was intentional. What did you think about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think he's just trying to generate a dialogue because he doesn't really come down on one side or the other saying that the savages are, the so-called savages in the book are the ideal, are great, or civilization is great. He's kind of just, I guess he's separating it into two different camps, like the Morlock and Eloi in a sense, but he's saying there's pluses and minuses of both. Like John, who's the savage character, he is like controlled by his emotion and he basically like physically assaults a woman because she takes off her clothes and wants to have sex with him, right? Because he believes in like modesty.
Monogamy,
yeah. And basically, so what's interesting
Whereas
about
Whereas in civilization, everyone's sleeping with everyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah, it's
you
big
know,
orgy all the time. And
orgy porgy, they call
they
it.
They actually say that, yeah. So in general, I think the social forces in society today are going more towards kind of openness about sex. So you have people now who associate themselves or identify themselves as being like polyamorous and obviously homosexuality and transsexual and all these kinds of things are becoming more accepted in our society. And this is something that's completely accepted in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World society.
Right.
So it's
not crazy.
So it's totally not crazy. And this is one of the things that I think is sort of a good thing. There's even though it's this kind of theoretically controlling society, it's very socially liberated.
It's adaptive.
You could do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much.
It's like, kind of, it's not, it's less controlling and more like they've figured out what people and civilization want. And the technology has allowed them to just have that level of experience all the time. You know, they just get that. They get whatever they want all the time just because they want it, not because there's any control or anything like that.
But then we come back to, if there's no negative experience, does it invalidate the positive? Like, can you be happy all the time without having negative experiences?
Yeah, that's a tough one. We never really resolved that. I don't think we're going to get to the bottom of that one. I think that's like a...
That's like the age-old
question. Yeah. Like, do you, like, is there meaning or not?
Right.
That's basically what it says. Much. Do things mean something?
If we solve that, I think we could just shut down the podcast and pretty much shut down all of civilization because we've answered the question,
Isn't it crazy that's the one thing we've been arguing about since the beginning of time? Not arguing, but like people can't figure
it
out. Yeah. I guess we have been arguing.
I think there probably is no answer. Honestly, it's just pretty random, and I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I used to stress out about that question a lot more, but then I got to a place where I realized that either everything means something and it's my job to discover what the meaning is, or it doesn't matter what I make of it. There's no apparent reason that any of us should know whether or not there's meaning. So, like, why waste your time, like, obsessing over it?
Right. If you waste your time obsessing about that, you're not going to enjoy your life, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe just be thankful and grateful and just enjoy
your
life. Enjoy your lunch or enjoy your life?
Enjoy your lunch. One step at a time. Be in the moment.
I said, I said enjoy your life. You said enjoy your lunch.
Enjoy
which is more profound.
No, I think enjoy your lunch. It's introspective. It's being in the moment.
Do you remember the end of the book when Bernard and Mustafa Mond are criticizing science?
Yeah, they've invented all they need to invent, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And science only brings instability, which is true, actually. So people have always feared this. This is another thing John Zerzan was talking about, because you have what's called creative destruction. And it's something that we experience today where people invent like robots that can do better jobs than humans. And then people lose their job.
Right.
So technology puts people out of work. And I guess this is why I was sort of wondering in Brave New World why they even bother having the lower castes, because they apparently have robots. Like, if you look at the factory that produces all the people, it's really automated. There's like robots moving everyone around.
Yeah.
So they clearly have the technology to like perform, to do the job, but then they actually just breed people to fill that role anyway, for some reason. I don't know. I guess they think somehow it contributes to social stability to have multiple different, like a hierarchy of castes. But it's unclear why they would bother, you know, breeding simple people to perform simple jobs when
that part falls apart for me because maybe he just didn't think that robots would ever get to the place where they could replace humans on that level.
I think that's the case, actually. I think this is a lack of force. I mean, he was really insightful in lots of places, but I think this is one place where he didn't anticipate.
I think you're right.
As much.
Yeah.
And computing and robotics. Those are the things that have really changed in the last 100 years is computers, 50 years more so, but yeah.
So really, we're going to have probably a more accurate depiction of what we're heading towards is we're going to have alphas, betas, and robots.
Yeah, maybe. But no. Actually, if everyone was an alpha, it would be kind of an ideal society to some extent, because they even talk about how the alphas aren't really conditioned very much and they're able. We wanted to keep some people who were able to think for themselves.
Well, they did the experiment with
the alphas
on the island.
It completely broke down.
Yeah,
they killed each other.
Yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
It's like an island full of Sylvester Stallones or something.
Yeah.
We're going to turn it over to the listeners. What did you think about Brave New World? Did you read it? Did you just listen to us talk about it? Engage yourself in the conversation by leaving a comment, especially if you're watching on YouTube. That's a great place to do it. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. That's a great way to not have to think about anything. You let the computers do all the work. If you want to send an email, I'd love to hear from you. Hello@spellboundshow.com. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to this every week, and I can't wait for next Monday.